You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a conversation with one of the best-known musicians from New Orleans. Jen White meets Troy Andrews, better known to his fans around the world as Trombone Shorty. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the pandemic shook up the world of work a lot, and things still haven't necessarily settled down. Big picture, the latest national job numbers slowed down a bit, but they still look pretty good, and unemployment stays low. The Great Resignation saw lots of people changing jobs. There are some signs that we're settling in. For some kinds of jobs, remote work was a game changer. That opened the door for many women in the workplace, but some employers are looking to bring people back to the office. And we've talked a lot on the show about worker shortages in many fields, from the police department to the IT department and childcare to senior care. Our next guest is following all these trends, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Millions of Americans have changed jobs, even careers, in the last couple of years. Are you one of them? We'd love to hear your story. And has remote work changed your work for better or worse? Has it opened up an opportunity for you? And is your workplace having trouble finding new people to work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Insider covering the workplace and the economy. Aki, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've talked to you about the Great Resignation, you know, the wave of people changing jobs, quitting jobs, whatever. Some articles out there saying we're starting to slow down on that. People are settling into jobs. What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, some economists are starting to call it the big stay now instead of the great resignation. And the main number that they're looking at is the national quits rate, the number of people who are quitting their jobs, either to drop out of the workforce altogether, but usually to move on to a different job. They're switching jobs. And this number was at just completely record highs, way, way above numbers we'd ever seen before the pandemic. Back in late 2021, most of 2022. But now that we're getting into the middle of 2023, it is coming back down pretty close to those pre-pandemic levels. It's still pretty high, but it's a lot lower than it was about a year ago.
Do we have, I mean, we kind of knew, I think, what was driving some of the great resignation, people leaving, people forced to leave jobs in some cases, they were closed down, people rethinking, do I want to be working with the public? A lot of factors going on there. Do we have a sense of why those numbers, that quit rate is coming back down?
I think some of it is that people have now found the work arrangement that they like or that they're comfortable with. So there was kind of this like shuffling around, you know, maybe in the last 2 years where people were switching to companies if they wanted to work remotely, you know, fully remote companies, or if they wanted to go into the office more to fully in-office companies. I think that's starting to settle down. So that's a factor. But another big one is that the economy is certainly not in a recession, but it's starting to slow. And that means that workers are getting a little bit more anxious about, changing jobs compared to before. And so they're preferring to kind of stay put where they are, where they're comfortable, than taking the risk of moving to a different company and, you know, potentially putting themselves up for a layoff.
Now that's one big switch, the great resignation to maybe the big stay. You recently wrote about another one. Now, early in the pandemic, and I think you and I talked about this, women left the workforce in much higher numbers than men. And there was a worry, like, is this going to be a permanent forever thing? What's been happening? Not that.
Yeah, the complete opposite ended up happening. And this is one of the most remarkable stories over the last few years. It's hard to believe that this was only 3 years ago when we were worried that the pandemic would end up setting an entire generation of working women back. But when you look at the numbers now, the labor force participation rate for women who are between 25 and 54, that is now at a record high. So it's not only completely erased the pandemic drop, but it's reached new records that we've never seen before. And that's definitely thanks to the work from home revolution, because remote and hybrid jobs are making it easier for working mothers to juggle their jobs with their family responsibilities.
That's amazing, because I mean, there's a lot of lines of work where you can't do work from home, you know, medical care, working at a restaurant. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's enough jobs out there still doing at least some remote that's moving the needle that much on women's employment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're certainly right that this is definitely a mostly white collar phenomenon, something that is accessible only to people who have a college degree. But yeah, the numbers are big enough to really make a difference. One economist estimates that remote and hybrid jobs that have opened up in the pandemic may have brought as many as 1.3 additional women into the workforce, which is an incredible number.
1.3 million?
Yeah.
And how is that affecting, or well, I guess it's early days. Is that something that's going to change like a career arc where, you know, it might be women might go to part-time or take time off to raise kids? Just they're more likely to do that than men in our culture as it is. Is this a thing where like, nope, we're going to keep that career going, remote work and do the kid thing all at once?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly the hope. The numbers that we're looking at, the labor force participation rate includes both women who are taking on full-time jobs and also part-time jobs. But I think in a lot of cases in the past, before the pandemic, if, you know, women who have young kids decided to if they didn't decide to drop out of the workforce altogether, they were scaling back and taking, you know, lower paid part-time jobs that were more flexible instead. So if they can keep, you know, those full-time jobs instead, you know, in more elite careers, if you will, then that's definitely a good sign for the gender pay gap.
Talking to Aki Ito from Insider. She covers workplace and the economy as a senior correspondent there, looking at big stories in the world of work. Post-pandemic, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have we been talking about you? Are you working remotely, full or part-time? Or were you and now you've gone back, whether you wanted to or not? Did you change jobs or careers over the last few years? Do you feel settled into your current job? Did you retire in the last few years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aki, as you just mentioned, remote work, giving women a vehicle to do a lot of different jobs now. But you've also been reporting on pushback from employers trying to reel people back into the office who are currently working remotely. What kind of conflicts are we seeing out there now?
It continues to be the case that employees want to work from home a little bit more than employers want them to. You know, if you're an employee, you think I can work perfectly productively from home. I can, and that allows me to, you know, juggle my responsibilities to my family or, you know, to going to the gym or, you know, getting groceries in the middle of the day. So it's incredibly convenient for employees. But employers are thinking a little bit more about the long run. They're asking, you know, if we have a fully remote workforce, how are our youngest employees going to be mentored and trained? If we don't have people who are interacting in person on a pretty regular basis, you know, is that going to create communication and coordination problems down the road? So there's slightly different incentives between employers and employees when it comes to the return to office debate, which is why you're seeing a continued clash between these two parties.
And you wrote, I hadn't seen this out there until I read your reporting on this, Aki. One answer to that for some companies is, okay, yeah, we'll keep having remote workers, but they're not employees anymore. They're contractors with fewer benefits. What kind of shifts are we seeing there?
Yes, I think this is one of the, you know, somewhat scarier unintended consequences of the work from home revolution. You know, companies always wanted to have contractors, to have part-time employees, to have temps who they can pay less, you know, certainly in benefits like healthcare and 401k matching, that kind of thing. But they were scared about trusting people who they've never met before, who they wouldn't be able to supervise in person every day, which made it hard for them to actually make the leap to hiring more contractors or part-time employees. What's happening now, though, is that because of this huge influx of remote work in the pandemic, a lot of managers are realizing, oh, we don't actually have to, you know, be supervising our employees every single day in person. You know, they're perfectly capable of getting their work done at home. And that's opening up this possibility for employers to move to these more alternative work arrangements, which are cheaper for the companies. But it's a bit scary for us workers who rely on all these benefits that come with full-time employment, like health insurance, like pensions, like disability insurance, that kind of thing. I think it speaks to how there are tons of benefits that are coming from the work from home revolution, but there are some unintended consequences as well.
Aki Ito is with us, senior correspondent at Insider. We're looking at the latest in the world of work, including the possible end of the Great Resignation, when so many people were quitting jobs, switching jobs, maybe even finding new careers, the ongoing impact of remote work, and coming up, baby boomers retiring. You could share your story or your questions at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten out of the workforce lately, maybe to care for kids or to retire? Or have you jumped back into the job world recently? Has remote work been a part of your story? Are you one of the many people who changed jobs, changed careers over the course of the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. Oh, and if you're looking to hire people, are people applying? 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Insider, covering the workplace and the economy. We're getting the latest on the job market, the Great Resignation, the pros and cons of remote work, a big jump in the number of women, the percentage of women in the workforce. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Pretty quiet out there. I think there are a lot of jobs out there in Wisconsin. Are we talking about your story? If you're a woman in the workforce, if you recently joined, love to hear from you. If you've experienced remote work for better or worse, tell us about it. Are you seeing a labor shortage where you work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. I mentioned labor shortages a couple times, Aki. Another piece you wrote recently looked at the concept of a forever labor shortage, as the big group of people we know as baby boomers are more and more leaving the workforce, retiring. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, so there's a massive demographic shift that's going on right now in the U.S. workforce. And we've known that this was coming for many decades. This has been kind of like a slow-moving revolution that economists always knew was coming. But the interesting thing is the pandemic ended up accelerating that a little bit. So it's hitting all at once because the pandemic prompted a lot of older people who are maybe usually a little early to retire permanently instead. So now what we're seeing is, you know, huge numbers of baby boomers are retiring, leaving the workforce, and the generations that are younger than them, Gen X, millennials, Gen Zers, they're all smaller generations than baby boomers were. So they're having trouble kind of filling the shoes of all the older people who are leaving the workforce. And as a result, we're basically seeing zero growth in the labor force.
And people might say, okay, well, that's great news if you are a worker. That's going to switch the balance of power to your favor. You're in demand. Is it playing out that way?
It absolutely is. And I mean, when you look at what happened over the last 2 years, a big reason why workers were able to get higher wages, better working conditions, was because there was a severe staffing shortage across the economy. Now, the last 2 years, what we were seeing, at least initially, was mostly because of the pandemic. But now, today, we're continuing to see staffing shortages across industries. And that's looking more like a permanent thing because it's driven by the demographic shift that we're seeing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us in Clinton. Katie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I happen to be a terminal manager for a bus company in Clinton, and we service our local school district. But one of the things that we're always looking for bus drivers, and what people don't realize about the job of bus driving is that it's in the morning and then in the afternoon. So you're, you know, during the daytime, you're free to go grocery shopping or whatever. But one of the things that I tend to specialize at my terminal is stay-at-home moms. These are women that have kids in the school district, but they might have a little one at home, but they want to try to get back into that workforce. We have child ride-alongs, so they can bring those little ones right onto the bus with them. Actually, we have one gal who had a baby over the summertime, and she's coming back at the beginning of the school year. We supply a car seat for her little guy.
Interesting.
So that might I fit what my needs are around their schedules. So as an employer, we get real creative, and if somebody's looking for a job, go to your local bus company.
Katie, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing this. Aki, do we see a lot of workplaces like Katie finding ways to accommodate the needs of that parent who might need to bring their kid on the job, whether that's an office or a bus?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love hearing that. It's really a really good example of how a really competitive job market, you know, where there are tons of jobs, but not enough people to fill them, how that ends up forcing employers to be creative and allow people who previously couldn't work to work now. One of the things that I talked about in my piece about the forever labor shortage is that it's really going to put a lot of pressure on companies to employ more women like that with young kids, or maybe people with disabilities, or maybe people with previous criminal records that they might have ignored or shunned in the past, just because there's so few additional workers to tap with this demographic shift that we're seeing. So I really love that story that Katie just shared.
Katie, thanks a lot for calling at 800-642-1234. Matt joins us now in West Bend. Matt, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to see what your opinion was on how the switch to work from home affects the commercial real estate market. I've read a lot that kind of as companies are switching to work from home and they're kind of uninvesting from commercial real estate, that's the reason there's a lot of big companies pushing workers back into the office is because of their investment in commercial real estate.
Interesting, Matt. Thanks for the call. And Aki, I read this all the time too, that places with big commercial downtowns, not just the commercial real estate itself, but all the restaurants and things like that that serve the workers who aren't coming down. How big an impact is that having?
It's having a huge impact. I mean, this is a real, it's a real crisis for the entire commercial real estate industry. But really, you know, the office buildings that are taking the biggest hit are the ones that are in downtown cities. I used to live in San Francisco. I lived there for 8 years. And if you go to San Francisco today, it's a ghost town. It looks completely different from what it used to look like before the pandemic, because there's so few people who are, you know, walking around, getting coffee, eating, you know, their expensive $25 salads. So the work from home shift is affecting not just, you know, the commercial real estate companies that don't have office tenants in there anymore, but also all of these, you know, surrounding, you know, small businesses that used to serve those busy office workers. They don't have enough customers anymore. So a lot of those businesses are starting to close in downtown cities as well.
Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. Aki, is this something that we think the market might regulate? Like, oh, I have a business that couldn't have afforded that San Francisco or wherever office space 5 years ago. Everybody's moved out. Maybe I can move my business in there now. Is there any thought that might happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, one of the really big hopes, especially for downtown cities like San Francisco, is that we'll be able to convert some of those commercial real estate buildings into residential real estate too. And so, you know, if we can do that quickly and efficiently, which has, you know, traditionally been difficult in the past because of all kinds of zoning laws, then I think that would be a win for everybody, because it'll help bring down home prices and rents. And at the same time, you know, we'll make new use of that space that is currently sitting empty.
Bringing things back around to our starting point, Aki, we've talked about a couple of things that changed a lot over the last few years, so it's hard to predict what the future is going to look like. What do you have your eye on now when it comes to work? What's the next thing that you might be writing a big piece on?
Well, probably the big thing that I'm really thinking about is artificial intelligence. These tools like ChatGPT have been such a game changer. And, you know, I just hear every single day from workers across industries about how they're using these tools to work more efficiently, to work more productively. And so I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, what do these tools mean for the job market today? And what does it mean for the job market maybe 5, 10, 15 years down the road?
Aki, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
That's Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Insider, covering the workplace and the economy. We've got a link, by the way, to a recent piece she wrote on remote work and women in the workforce. You can find that over at wpr.org/centraltime. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's a chance some Wisconsinites might be able to see the Northern Lights tonight. We'll learn about that and other stargazing opportunities this summer. First, a Bayfield County farmer survived for 19 days in the Canadian wilderness as a contestant on the 10th season of Alone, the History Channel's televised survival competition. Though she was the second of 10 contestants to call for help, she made Wisconsin proud by demonstrating her survival expertise, hunting, foraging, trapping, and braving the elements completely on her own.
It's a very hard decision, and it feels like it's too early. I don't want to go. I really like it here, but I think it's a huge accomplishment even just to be where I'm at, you know. I can't believe I'm here. It's a gift. It really is.
Ann Rosenquist is an organic farmer, forager, and survivalist in northern Wisconsin, where she co-owns Northwind Organic Farm in Bayfield County. She's here to talk about the challenges and triumphs she encountered while fending for herself in one of the harshest environments in North America. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. It's good to be here.
Where did you learn your very impressive, I gotta say, survival skills?
I think it's just my life, my whole life. I grew up on a small resort on the north shore of Lake Superior. I do a lot of primitive skills, different events, and teach at different things. Just picking up things and having the interest and reading books, and it's just kind of what I like to do.
What made you say, yes, I want to try this challenge of going on the show alone and see how long I could last?
Well, it's kind of the perfect opportunity because you get to go out and go as far as you can, and then there's a tap-out button, and they come and pick you up. So,
what were you hoping to get out of it? What made you want to be out there and show off these skills?
Well, the final prize, of course, is the final person out there. If they outlast everybody else, gets $500,000. That's nice, I guess. I'm not sure I ever expected to get that, but I learned a lot about myself out there and just what I'm capable of and what I'm not capable of.
Now, I want to set the scene here a little bit. I always assume that these shows, there is a camera crew that shows up from time to time around you. I have that wrong, right? There's just some stationary cameras.
No, actually, they give you a huge box full of camera gear, and they train you ahead of time. So, you know, a couple GoPros and some other different cameras, and you film yourself. And you can have a couple going at one time. You know, you might have one on your body and one in the distance. You have a mic on you at all times. So you're basically filming yourself from the time you get up in the morning until you go to bed.
What was it like just being, you know, totally alone, apart from the survival element of this, but like, you know, the only person to talk to is, I guess, you.
Well, you can talk to the camera, but then you realize the camera ran out of batteries, you know, so that's not, I don't know. There were different, like there was a gray jay that kept coming through camp and my little camp, you know, and there was squirrels that came through and I didn't really feel too alone, actually.
What was the first challenge you decided to tackle there? Was it food, shelter, water? What was your priority as you settled into your temporary home there?
You know, I basically was kind of working on food and shelter both at the same time. Food was hard. They didn't show everything I did for food, but I made a gill net. I had the wind coming at me the whole time, either from the south or the north. It was always coming in my direction on my little spit of land that I was allowed to stay in. So I decided that I was going to swim my little lure that I made out into the water, swim back, and then reel it in to get it out far enough. That was not successful.
What were some of your most successful foraging and hunting and fishing methods?
Oh, I found quite a bit of wild mushrooms. I did get a grouse. I tried, you know, eating reindeer moss, which is edible if you, like, boil it, like, three times. If you don't boil it, then it's poisonous and you die. But I tried different things like that. Basically, I got so hungry and so dehydrated that I had to come back.
Yeah, as I understand it, what made you have to come back, you're feeling pretty bad, and one of the reasons was a shortage of salt, which, you know, as Americans, that's not something we experience very often. What was it like to have this, what we take for granted, this mundane material salt, be such an obstacle in the wilderness?
Yeah, you know, I sort of had this inkling in the back of my head that maybe salt was important, and I actually, that could be one of your 10 items. But I kind of changed it up and didn't bring the salt. And I'm sorry I didn't do that because that would have really helped me.
We're talking to Ann Rosenquist, organic farmer in Bayfield County, about her experience by herself on the TV show Alone on the History Channel, 19 days in the Canadian wilderness. You mentioned those 10 items, Ann, and I imagine you get to pick 10 things to bring with you. I imagine that must have been some excruciating decision making. How did you set those priorities?
Oh, and I went back and forth, you know, I went back and forth of what I was going to bring, but I finally, you know, decided on different things. And I think if I were to do it again, it would be a different set of 10 things.
Now, if people out there are thinking, yeah, I'd like to try some survival type outdoor experience, but they don't have the kind of background you have, what kind of things could people do to learn those skills and learn what the challenges that they might face before they just put themselves out there?
Oh, I think you can find a lot of stuff on YouTube, and there's books written by different survivalists, like Morris Klochanski. He's an old timer. He's, you know, long gone, and other different people. Going to primitive skills events, they're kind of fun. They're usually a week long. They're all over the country. They're fun.
I was looking at the website for Northwind Organic Farm, and you clearly have a big priority on minimizing your environmental impact. Can you talk about kind of your philosophy and how maybe being out there and alone reinforced that connection with the environment?
Actually, you know, I think the two of them go side by side. It's kind of making do with what you have. We're off grid up here. We like to work with the environment instead of working against it. So we have a lot of different variety of crops. So if there's a crop failure, we're not going to go down. So we grow a lot of different fruits and vegetables, and it's all in different little areas. And it's kind of a crazy lifestyle. We have used cars and the off-grid thing with the solar panels, and we don't buy very many new things, you know.
Now, you went through this experience on 19 days in the Canadian wilderness. Given the opportunity, would you do it again?
Of course. I would.
Is there a type? Go ahead.
Oh, it was just fun. I mean, I'm more scared of people than, you know, of wild animals. So I wasn't scared out there. It was kind of like my own space, you know, I could just be my own person out there.
Yeah, you described it elsewhere as a spiritual experience when you look back at it. Could you talk about that a little?
It really was. It was so pristine up there. You know, we flew in a small plane even to get up to that lake, Reindeer Lake, way up in northeastern Saskatchewan. There's nothing down below. There's no people. There's no roads. It's so beautiful. And that white reindeer moss with the black spruce, it's more of a primitive environment, too. There's a lot less variety of plants.
Is there another place you'd like to do a challenge? Is there an environment in the world where you'd like to, you know, give it a try and spend 10, 20, 30 days there?
Probably the north, probably somewhere in the north. I'm not sure I'm made for the tropics.
Do you have favorite areas in Wisconsin, whether you're just going for a hike or camping, even if it's not, you know, a more extreme survival type scenario?
Well, Bayfield County is pretty nice. I like to go up to Mount Ashwaubea and cross-country ski in the winter and kayak on Lake Superior in the summer and go for hikes and look for mushrooms. And it's a pretty peaceful place up here. And it's cool today. It's only 67 degrees.
Not bad. Now, you mentioned that on the farm you live off the grid as much as possible. The solar panels are one part of that. What are some of the things you've developed over the years to reduce your impact and reduce your reliance on outside inputs?
We have an electric tractor that we use for tilling. We have a few electric cars that we run around the farm with that we're using. We power them from the sun because we're totally off grid. We actually have batteries that charge up our systems. We also have a wind generator. So we're pretty self-reliant in that way.
Now, getting back to a loan, something I wanted to ask, Ann, you know, I got to say, it's kind of painful watching you in the last moments of your experience there, trying to figure out what was wrong, if you needed to call for help. Have you gone back and watched that yourself?
I have, and it's hard for me to watch. I didn't edit it. Uh-huh. I wish they wouldn't have put that in there, but I think they like to relate to the audience and stuff. I'd rather they would have showed me doing something instead of being all touchy-feely. I am sort of Scandinavian, you know.
Yeah. What didn't we end up seeing on the show that you wish had been there, seeing Ann Rosenquist in action?
Well, you know, there was that swimming with the lures. I also spent a lot of time chasing a squirrel that lived up above me. He had this huge complex with probably 20 different holes that it went into this huge pile of, like, cones from black spruce tree, and it was enormous. And he was out there just the king of whatever, and I got right up to him and I just missed him with my bow. But every time he saw me, he would hide the whole time. So I spent a lot of time waiting for him. It was kind of hilarious, actually.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you
okay.
So much for sharing this experience with us.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
That's Ann Rosenquist, a forager and off-grid organic farmer living in Bayfield County. She survived for 19 days in the Canadian wilderness as a contestant on the 10th season of Alone, the History Channel's televised survival competition. New episodes of Alone air Thursdays at 8 Central on the History Channel. Coming up, did you know honeybees are farm animals that aren't native to the United States? A conservation biologist explains the difference between honeybees and native bees, North American native bees, and the role each plays in our food system. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard in the last few years that honeybees were under threat after an increase a few years back in a problem known as colony collapse disorder. Those honeybees are a non-native species in North America. They play a huge role in agriculture, both in honey production and for pollinating a wide variety of crops. But the concerns about honeybees and their importance in agriculture may have overshadowed a big ecological problem. Many of the nearly 4,000 bee species that are native to North America are under different forms of threats because of habitat loss, pesticides, and other reasons. Rich Hatfield is a senior endangered species conservation biologist and bumblebee conservation lead at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I want to spend a little bit of, or most of our time on the native bees. I want to touch on honeybees for a moment. We might look at bees and think bees are bees. Honeybees have a very different background and story in North America. Can you tell us a bit about that history?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, they're not native. They were, so they weren't naturally here, but back in the early 1600s, as Europeans were moving to North America, because honeybees provided a source of sugar and also a source of wax, they decided to bring them over. And the earliest records were in the early 1600s, I think 1620s. And I think their first arrival was in Jamestown, Virginia. And records indicate that by sort of the mid-1800s that honeybees had reached to the West Coast and been spread by people all the way out there. But all of the history of the European honeybee or the Western honeybee coming to North America involves humans bringing them here. They weren't here on their own. Although it is worth noting that there is a early fossil of a related species, a related honeybee in the genus Apis that was found in Nevada a few years ago. So there may have been a native honeybee at one time, but that was millions of years ago and went extinct before people were ever in the picture.
And then let's turn to native bees. Thousands of different species native to the continent. I understand we've been talking about honeybees. The native bees in North America, none of them produce honey. Do I have that right?
None of them produce any measurable amount of honey. We have around 50 species of bumblebees, and they may produce sort of small pockets of honey that they feed their larvae when they're developing. But almost all of our native bees spend their winter hibernating. So they sleep through the winter. So they have a different strategy for surviving, whereas honeybees spend all summer making that honey. So they have something to eat in the wintertime, and they overwinter sort of alive, which is different than our native bees.
What are some of the main strategies of overwintering? A big issue for a native bee here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are overwintering in a small hole in the ground, probably, you know, in your garden or in a yard somewhere. Some of them also overwinter in like pithy stems or twigs of trees or shrubs or even perennial plants. And so actually leaving some of that material in your yard is really important. Leaving some of those dead stems up and actually leaving some of the leaves on the ground provides really important insulation that protects those animals through the winter.
A lot of your work, of course, has to do with endangered and threatened bee species in North America. How endangered are some of these bee species?
The short answer to the question is we don't really know. There are, I think you mentioned, there are thousands of species of native bees to North America. And so in the United States and Canada, we have somewhere around 3,600 species. And for most of those species, we have very little understanding of their conservation status. But we do have a pretty good understanding of the conservation status of bumblebees, which are fairly well studied. Most people are probably familiar with them. They're large, robust, black and yellow for the most part, and they're fairly well studied. And we have some indication that around, or not some indication, the data indicates that around a quarter of them are facing some degree of extinction risk. And several of them are critically endangered. One species, Bombus franklinii, or Franklin's bumblebee, which is native to Northern California and Southern Oregon, actually hasn't been detected since 2006. And some folks actually think it may already be extinct. And then there in Wisconsin, you know, you have the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally listed endangered species. And so the two species I just mentioned, the rusty patch bumblebee and Franklin's bumblebee, are two bumblebees that are federally listed as endangered. And then there are actually seven yellow-faced or hyalaeus bees that are endemic to Hawaii that are also on the endangered species list. So I know that's kind of a long answer to your question, but in short, it sounds like really when we start looking at the data that around a quarter of the species are probably facing some degree of extinction risk.
What are a couple of the biggest reasons that these bees are endangered?
Well, you mentioned them in sort of your introduction of the segment. You know, habitat loss is a major one. The use of insecticides is also incredibly important, especially over the last, you know, 20 to 25 years or so, has been an increasing use of systemic insecticides, which are water soluble and get into plants and are expressed in the pollen and nectar, which are the only food for bees. So that's a really important source of a threat for them. And climate change is also a major factor as well. It's changing the time at which our plants bloom, and it's causing sort of crazy springtime, winter storms, and other things that are just impacting their life cycle. And so all of these factors sort of keep piling on top of each other, and you get a scenario that is commonly referred to sort of as a death by a thousand cuts. And another factor that's really happening, especially to some of our bumblebees, is disease is a major factor. So, you know, you mentioned honeybees at the beginning. There's some pretty good evidence that shows that when we move honeybees around, we're actually moving diseases around with them as well, and they can pass those diseases to our native bees as they visit flowers with each other. And there's also a commercial bumblebee industry that is believed to be amplifying and spreading diseases throughout the country. So a lot of threats out there. But the good news is a lot of those things are things we can do something about. We just need to band together and work to mediate to get rid of those threats.
And very briefly, just in our last half minute, you mentioned we can leave our yards untidy in the winter to help. Can we make a difference literally by planting native flowers for the rest of the season?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the great things about pollinator conservation is it's a build it and they will come scenario. If you start putting habitat in the ground, and the Xerces Society has a ton of resources on our website to help you do that, you will bring bees there. And that's what we're really encouraging folks to do, is to focus on building habitat rather than, say, getting a honeybee hive, because you may be bringing them into the system that doesn't have enough food to feed them already. So we want to focus on building habitat, and that will support our native bees and the honeybees that are already on the landscape.
Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Rich Hatfield with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. He talked to us today about native bees, many of which are endangered or threatened, and how to help them out around North America. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about what we can expect to see in the night sky in Wisconsin this summer. We had a shot at the Northern Lights tonight. Looks like that's not going to happen, but we may get more chances in the future. By the way, you could join in if you've seen the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. Love to hear your story. Maybe see some pictures over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.